My name is John Crichton. I'm lost. An astronaut shot through a wormhole in some distant part of the universe, trying to stay alive aboard this ship, this living ship of escaped prisoners, my friends. I'm Eddie Webb.
And I'm Chris Spivey.
And today we're going to talk about Farscape on Genres. Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Genreless, where we talk about different genre TV shows because we like to, and that's what we're here for. And today we're going to do a show that I loved but also have not watched in a long time, Farscape, which is, I think, a good one to follow Buck Rogers, because when we were originally talking about this, I had made the comment that I felt like Farscape embodied the kind of gonzo nature of 70s sci-fi in a way that I hadn't really seen outside of the 70s.
There's definitely a campy nature that stays with Farscape that it plays with.
Mm-hmm. And what was interesting to me is I remembered Buck Rogers being more serious before I watched it, and I remembered Farscape being funnier before I watched it, and I was wrong on both cases. I was like, yeah, Farscape's kind of goofy and weird. It's like, it is weird, but man, it is not funny. I mean, it has funny moments, but it's very much drama. But before I go into all that, what was your experience with Farscape?
Well, I was thinking maybe we should actually sort of, since you touched on it, maybe we tell them originally we had Buck Rogers, I think, slotted almost as our number two or number three show. Mm-hmm. So it would have had a little bit of the Star Trek. And then we would have gone to Buck Rogers.
Right.
And then we sort of shifted back to things, which didn't feel quite right. So that was some of the different dynamics behind the scene. We're trying to figure out the right flow for the show. Mm-hmm. And then we're doing Farscape. And we thought Buck Rogers and Farscape both sort of had a character displaced and interacting with, for Crichton, more aliens. And compared to Buck, just future people.
It is interesting, like, when you watch it back to back, the premises are on the surface very similar. The big difference is Buck was frozen and circled back to Earth eventually, whereas John Crichton is just flung off into space. But it's the same rough idea. Lone American goes into space, something bad happens, and now he's in a strange alien environment, and he is the fish out of water. But you're right, from there, they become very different shows, and they're both fun in their own way, I think. What was your experience before rewatching it? Have you watched Farscape before?
I watched Farscape from week to week, and when it came out, I even recorded the episodes on the VHS for the kids listening. VHS tapes were these great little plastic devices with tape in them, and you put them in the recorder, and it would record the episode. You could have them be a long play or a short play.
Yes, the 90s were weird.
And every chance I would get, I would watch some of the episodes because I really liked the different characters, the dynamics of the show, the campiness of it, which sort of spoke to me because I have a love of 70s science fiction. So coupled with love of 70s science fiction and in at that time, a modern setting with like great acting from all the cast, there was nothing not to love.
Mm-hmm. Right. My experience was a little bit similar. I watched the first season pretty much week to week, and then life happened, and I actually didn't get a chance to watch the rest of it. But that kind of early 2000s, when DVD box sets became really popular, I again borrowed it from our friends and watched the rest of the show, including the Peacekeeper Wars miniseries at the end. And I was like, oh, this is really great. And then I've never watched it again. It's weird. I generally watch things, but go ahead.
I was so addicted to Farscape that I think for a while on the Sci-Fi Channel or SIFI or whatever they call themselves, depending on the day, it would even make me watch Lex. They aired, I think, after it for a while. And Lex was not the best of shows.
Lex was... Oh my God. Yes. I was half convinced that it was a porn parody of Farscape for a long time. because it was just like, this is Farscape, but worse. And everyone's wearing half the clothing. What is happening here?
Well, there was Flash and Flash Gordon, so.
Right, right. But anyway, so for those of you who didn't watch Farscape or don't know what we're talking about, the main premise is astronaut named John Crichton. He prototypes a ship known as the Farscape, which can do faster than light travel. Something goes wrong. He is catapulted across the universe. His ship is destroyed. He ends up being brought aboard a ship, which turns out to have been a prison ship. And the prisoners have overthrown the peacekeepers and have taken control of the ship. We also learn very quickly that the ship is alive. And I think one of the most noteworthy things about it that people remember, even if they haven't really watched the show too much, is that this was an attempt by Jim Henson's son to try to do to bring animatronic puppeteering back into mainstream consciousness. So two of the main characters are, in fact, puppets. And again, it's one of the things, like, when you kind of see it from that side, you think, oh, this is going to be a goofy show because it has puppets and, you know, people saying funny words. But it's not. It's actually extremely dramatic. And there are certainly – these are characters that you come to love and or hate, depending on which one you're talking about, throughout the course of the show. They are just as important and vital as the actual human actors. I think that leads into kind of the premiere where all that stuff I just said happens. The other thing that's interesting about the show is that it is primarily an Australian production. So a lot of the actors are Australian or from New Zealand, with the exception of the actor who played John Crichton, who was American. And it's one of those things that I didn't notice it at first, but it was interesting because all of the characters more or less had Australian or New Zealand accents, and they all sounded good together as a group. And so John Crichton sounds wrong. And it's a subtle way of really selling the fact that this is an unusual environment for John to be in.
And I think part of that, though, not only the language aspects of it, but their acting styles are also somewhat different, which could be based either on the culture or actors' choices. And that really helped fuse them as a group and sort of individualize all the characters at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. It definitely seems like there was different physicalities kind of happening throughout the show. I mean, and there's lots of, like, the set design of Moria, the ship. It's also lots of angles and curves. I was reading some background on this, and one of the things that the producers wanted to do is that this was late 99, early 2000. And these various Star Treks were now off the air, and that they wanted to do a show that would fit into that mold of TV watching, but not be Star Trek. They wanted to try to get rid of themselves of as many of the Star Trek cliches as possible. So,
a living ship was also a great start for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, there isn't.
Were there?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
That's all right.
I was just excited about the show.
No, it is. Yeah. But one thing I noticed, like, is there isn't really a captain character. We've been doing the kind of the captain game, and there isn't really some. I mean, there are times when John Crichton's in charge, but there are also times when the crew is like, nah, I'm not listening to you.
So just like the Buck episode, I'll have to think of a new game.
Yes. See, so we can't rank that. I mean, unless you count Moya as the captain, which is valid. You dive in, and there's a sweet spot when you're starting a new realm, world, whatever. I read an article online. They call it the five finger rule. Is that if you are starting a new young adult novel, a fantasy or sci-fi or whatever, you should be able to count the new words on one hand. You know, if you have more than five instances of new words, you're probably overwhelming the reader. You have to kind of ease them into the unusual nature of the setting. And Farscape is surprisingly good at this because the setting is very different from anything else. There are human-looking characters, but they are a distinct species. Everyone else is either in makeup or is a puppet. There's a lot of politics going on that you're dumped in the middle of. And yet, the basics are pretty clear. It's like, you get on, it's pretty clear that these people are prisoners, they're escaping. There are people in smart black uniforms who are coming after them. John inadvertently destroys a ship, and the ship was piloted by the lead villain's brother, so he wants revenge for that. And even like the pilot, which is just basically just a big kind of head and shoulders behind a keyboard, but they're called pilot. And pretty quickly, John gets injected with microbes that translate by basically a disease that changes his brain.
Which is one of my favorite things about the show, because it gets rid of the trope of everyone sort of speaking the same language, mm-hmm. but it instantly gets you all sort of on the same page and able to communicate with each other.
Right. And there's actually even a great throwaway line of like, why didn't you have those already at birth? So everyone has these. Which again, just gets rid of the whole why does everyone speak English thing. It was weird that he got injected in his foot to get the microbes, but, you know, the little robots are only so tall. And again,
it would have been something else to see it do like a flying Kirk stab, though.
Right. Just flying through the air. He's holding it to his throat as he's pretending like he's trying to knock it off. But I mean, yeah, it's – and I'm watching it again. There's certainly parts of me like, oh, yeah, I remember this character and I remember this thing. But it was genuinely really good how they ease you into – the unusual parts of the setting. And I'm not going to jump to this just yet, but like when you jump ahead to episode 19, whatever, the weirdness is in full flow, but again, you don't feel lost. It's very carefully kind of building the pieces up. And this first episode is a good start. And also it's a really good premiere for a 45-minute episode.
Well, like the show itself, even with the first episode, felt somewhat groundbreaking. Because it touches on what you're talking about, the color choices they made, mm-hmm. the aesthetics for the ship being a living ship, and it moved it away from everything that we'd almost seen before. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Aaron, who is your primary like lead warrior and fighter, and Dargo, and your primary character, John, is almost like a dude in distress mm-hmm. for many of the episodes. And that's great to see. But it also, at the same time, it doesn't downplay the capabilities he has, but it has everyone else that sort of look down on him and consider humans to be a lesser species on the whole because they're not as resistant as they are. They're not capable of doing all these different things, but it has him sort of overcoming some of those things and then reaching a found family sort of place.
Right. And that's just, it's a good point because Buck comes back in and within one episode, there's a brief moment where he's like, I'm not sure how I can live in this world and blah, blah, blah. But within like the first two-parter, he's a badass and he's innovating space combat and, you know, just changing the world for the better because his 20th century knowledge is just so superior to 25th century knowledge. And you're right, in Farscape, John Crichton is often just in the way.
And he has occasional moments of like inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And then you still see him fighting against all the different aspects of him being out of his own space and missing his family, trying to find a place to be here with these beings and not sure if he can do it.
Right. So because you're probably more familiar with these characters than I am because it's been too long. Can you give a rundown of the crew, the core crew of the ship?
You've got Crichton, who we've mentioned, who's a human scientist. You've got Dargo, who is a Luxon warrior. You find out Dargo is actually a young Luxon warrior.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Pahu Zan, who is a peaceful priestess, which you later find out she's actually a revolutionary, which is pretty incredible. You've got Officer Aronson, who is one of the peacekeepers, who has to transition out of her old ways to learn to live with these aliens and everyone else who they had actually been policing.
Mm-hmm.
and Rigel are like the original core crew. And Rigel was a Dominar on his planet who's one of the puppets and is an infuriatingly lovable, irritating character.
He reminds me a lot of Londo from Bab 5.
Yes.
He doesn't have the same arc, but that kind of, I know I'm right, and I think I'm doing the right thing, but everyone else is just wrong and needs to acquiesce to me. There's definitely that piece of it there.
And one of the greatest part about the show is all the characters, even our good crew, do bad things. Mm-hmm. And the bad people do good things, but then go back to doing bad things. And they don't do bad things necessarily because they're the right thing to do. They do bad things just because they're people.
Right.
Sometimes it's easier to do a bad thing, but then they pay for later on somewhere down the line. Or not, because they might get away with it.
Mm-hmm. And even the setup for the show, the setup for season one, it starts to get muddier as seasons go on. But the setup for season one is basically this peacekeeper general wants to hunt them down and kill them because he believes John Creighton killed his brother. And it's fascinating because initially it seems like, oh, okay, here's the MacGuffin. We have to avoid this guy. But over the course of the show, you realize that this general is not gotten sanctioned for this feud. He's going against orders. And as to play with that space of, like you're saying, it's like he's doing bad things, but he thinks he's doing them for good reasons. I want to get revenge for my family. But then he just steadily spirals down. It reminds me a bit of Dukat from Deep Space Nine in a sense of you can almost see why the character is doing that. You almost sympathize with with why he's making these decisions, but still be like, no, but you're making bad decisions. You're still a bad person.
And it's great that like they can't kill Krace. So Krace is a reoccurring villain. Mm-hmm. One of the things about the show it does is that it loves its villains as much as it loves the primary cast of characters. And so they find ways to bring them back in. They pop up, sometimes helpful, usually not. But they have their own motivations, and that motivation is frequently and clearly established, and their machinations trying to make them happen. And they do actions that are sort of fall in line with what they've established as a character to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's one of the things that we talked about for the order we put this in initially, we kind of were just like, this feels right, this feels right. But it's been fascinating as we actually go through the shows, how this pairs well with previous shows, because it's like Farscape is in a lot of ways bits and pieces of all his previous shows at their best form. Because like this whole renegades who are trying to do good but are frequently forced to make terrible decisions is also very dark matter. You know, I can see echoes of the dark matter dynamic in Farscape, or more accurately, probably the way around. Like the dark matter probably had Farscape as an inspiration when they're making their show.
That folks can thank Guardians of the Galaxy on Farscape. Right. Like James Gunn has admitted that a lot of my inspiration came from Farscape.
I could definitely see that. I could definitely see that. Again, like the lone human who's not as good as he thinks he is around very alien characters. Farscape is also really interesting because a little thing I noticed, although I noticed it more in episode 19, Nerve. Star Wars has this thing where the very first movie, episode four, the Empire generally had British accents and the Rebellion generally had American accents. And then over the time of Star Wars, that gets muddy and blurred and ultimately becomes not a thing. In Farscape, they actually do play with that a bit more, where John Creighton actually takes on an Australian accent to try to infiltrate the peacekeepers. And it's, again, a little way of playing with language that sells without any makeup, you know, just a slight costume change. It's like, I'm trying to embody this different species, this different concept. And also with language, we mentioned it a little bit in the last episode, but like the fact they have not only fill in swear words like Frel, but even other concepts over time, even units of time, start to become this part of the universe's, you know, area of time. So they don't say hours, they don't say minutes, they say whatever the local time equivalent is.
Arns,
thank you.
Which is great because that sort of even makes it more alien in its own thing. And you're trying to like keep up with what an Arn would be, but it also lets them play with time in the narrative without giving someone like an easy clue. It's like, shouldn't that have happened already by now from like your time frame? But an Arn is an hour? Is it 2 hours?
We don't know. Right. We don't know. It's something vaguely resembling an hour. And in a lot of these kind of fish out of water shows, again, like Buck Rogers, for example, often what you see is the narrative will slowly adapt to fit the modern audience perspective. So people start to adapt Buck's mannerisms. Occasionally throw something out, they'll humorously go, I don't understand what that means, or pick a different thing with it, you know. But also we saw things like, you know, the growing plants became more and more a thing on the show. You know, and Buck's way of doing things started to become the way that everyone did things. This is the opposite happening. John's trying to adapt to the society scene because that's how it would work. He's like, you're one guy. We're an ancient civilization. You're going to do things our way or you're not going to get along very well. So he has to slowly adapt to that way of thinking. And it, because you can't really see people's thought processes in television, they do that brilliantly by adapting language. And like you said, in ways that we as the audience can get from context what it all means, but it was never actually explicitly explained. I think that's subtle and very, very cool.
And at the same time, then you have the crew that are always with Crichton, who, while they don't change dramatically, they do pick up small little things that Crichton does because he reinforces it. Mm-hmm. Like the handshake that he has, or how he does like a thumbs up with Dargo. But then that's the equivalent of what they picked up. It's like when you're hanging out with friends, you might use a word or two that they use frequently, but it doesn't change you or how you interact on the whole.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's like another like masterstroke of showing off things.
Yeah. And also like with these shows, sometimes you have one of two problems, which is either the characters injected in the situation immediately becomes friends with everyone, which is more or less what happens in Buck Rogers. Or everyone hates you and it becomes hard to keep the momentum going because they just irrationally hate you for some reason. Because Crichton looks human and the main villains also look human, the peacekeepers, there's almost kind of a racism kind of happening. It's like initially they're slow to warm up to him because he looks so much like the people they hate. And while the characters get over that, it does occasionally pop up in later episodes every now and then. And it's a really subtle way of going, yeah, of course they're going to rub each other the wrong way because it's hard to not think about that. It's not explicit. It's not stamped on there, but it's buried down the way that this is how people act. And you can get past it, and the crew absolutely does get past it. But it's not just hand waved away one episode. Okay, we're all friends now. No, it's still simmering there for a while, which is neat, I think.
It is. It's something that you have to work your way through constant interactions. But then it is also easy to backslide.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to like realize what you're doing and say, this is not what I should be doing. And then you try to like go back to an understanding state, which you have that multiple times, even throughout all the episodes that we watched, regardless of season one or season two. And that's great to see because it shows them as being living beings that aren't just a piece of the script, but how they should interact and their own emotional dynamics between each individual member of the crew is different. Like Dargo and John's friendship is a joy to watch throughout the entire course of the show, where it goes to distrust, to friends, to almost enemies and back and forth, and showing like the love that they acquire for each other, that they're almost become like brothers by the end of the show. But mm-hmm. It was a long road filled with trouble to get there.
Right. And the show also wasn't afraid to shake up the dynamic. So when we get to Nerve, we have now Chiana in the mix. And then there's a new tension because she's pretty openly a thief and a con artist. And so there's a lot of, can we trust her to do what she needs to do? But the conceit of the episode is they have to break into a peacekeeper base. And so they need a thief and a con artist to help them with that. And so the whole time, John's clearly not trusting Chiana. And Chiana's not making it easy to trust her because it's very clear that this is a character who tries to emotionally distance herself from people that she's manipulating. So she's used to enticing people in, but not actually letting them genuinely become friends with her or to get close to her. And so a lot of this episode is that tension between them and how John has built up some amount of trust with his found family of the crew. She's a new factor in that. And most of the crew are like, aren't sure if they can trust her or not, but they need her. And then, of course, it's complicated by the fact that a peacekeeper from an episode we skipped comes back and tries to help John. And so it's like, can we trust this peacekeeper as well on top of everything else? So it's – again, it reminds me of Dark Matter in a sense of it's a lot more character-driven than it would seem to be. It's the Soon is injured. We need to go to a peacekeeper base to get this medical MacGuffin. And the fact that we're even willing to do this shows how much we care about this character, even though she's not really prominent in the show, at least in this episode. And then a lot of the complications that happen are due to character choices. You know, the enemy general shows up. This is, the first appearance of Scorpius, or it's relatively early Scorpius.
I think this is Scorpius's first appearance.
Okay.
And curses to you, by the way, because you said we only had to watch Nerve, and I'd forgotten this was a two-part episode. And so there I was thinking, all right, I don't remember an ending like this. He should be out of the chair by now if this is the only one episode. Eddie! And so I had to watch the next episode.
Yeah, I did too. I did too. But
but don't forget, even before they got to the planet, how the crew themselves, it goes back to the relationships with Aaron. Most of the crew was like, I don't think we need to risk our lives trying to send you into a peacekeeper base.
Right.
You can't really fool them if you go in there. And it almost came down to a vote. And it was interesting to see who chose themselves over chose trying to save Aaron. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to Rigel, who up to now has really always been about Rigel, to side with John to save Aaron. Like, that was interesting character choice and dynamic, showing how that character has changed somewhat.
Right. And again, it's one of those things where when you have the right characters, you have the right actors, you can make those kinds of swerves, but you can trust, okay, there's a reason for this and it'll get spelled out later. And often it usually is. So it's like, you know, what is up with Rigel? Because Rigel's, again, not like Londo, is a character who always has a plan. He's in it for himself. But he believes that by being royalty, he naturally needs to do things for the people. It's just that he needs to be respected for being above those people he's helping. So he's always in this constant flux of doing what he believes to be the right thing and also keeping himself alive because he needs to stay alive.
Sort of like a properly written comic book version of Dr. Doom, where Dr. Doom wants to protect humanity. He just believes that no one else can do it as well as he can.
Oh, God, yeah. Dr. Doom is such an amazing character for that.
But that's when it's written right, and that's how they did for Rigel.
Right, yeah. There's certainly bad Dr. Doom, but when Dr. Doom, when he hits that sweet spot of patriot and villain, it's fantastic. And I think Rigel's in a similar boat, right? He's not quite a villain, but certainly he is the character that says the unpopular thing a lot. And sometimes the unpopular thing is something we as the audience go, that's actually not a bad point. In Nerve, John Crichton gets captured and tortured. We get a whole bunch of exposition to episodes we didn't watch and episodes that are coming up. So this is a hard choice because it is kind of in the middle of a few different plots. But I felt it was important to kind of show that really that the John-Chiana relationship, because it kind of takes a lot of tension to the show and in the microcosm, it shows the conflict of those two characters specifically. And then you're right, like the fact that Soon being injured was not an easy decision to make. So this is kind of peak. The crew is gelling, but there's still a lot of friction there.
And you even have the extra one for like John's own non-existent triangle, because the third member of that triangle isn't really in competition anymore from what John and Aaron have built for their own relationship going forward. Mm-hmm. And you get to build on that will they, won't I dynamic that was incredibly popular in television.
Right.
So there is that added level. And then you have Chiana, who's showing off more of her own cunning, trying to keep this person that helped John before they found out about John's feelings for Aaron on their side. Mm-hmm. By saying, yes, he loves you. Yes, he wants you to come with us. Mm-hmm. As long as you get me off of this base.
Right. And it was definitely setting a tone of, yeah, whatever, you love you. Just help me out here. But there's just enough in the background, the way Chiana, again, her body language, whatnot. Like, one thing I loved about the actress for Chiana is, first of all, she's acting through makeup, which is already hard. She's doing some subtle acting work through pretty moderately heavy makeup. But also, her body language when she's conning someone and her body language when she's being sincere is distinct, but it takes you a while to realize which is which. It's not until she's in full con mode where she's like, hitting people up for drinks and trying to get information, and you see, okay, this is her obviously in full manipulation mode. And then when you see her backing away from that, and her comments about, oh yeah, John loves you, was played as if she was being sincere. But the way that she read the line, it wasn't. So you start to see subconsciously the conflict the character has, which is, again, just chef's kiss. I can't say enough good things about the acting and the writing of the characters for this show, frankly.
And since it was a two-parter, we have to talk about the second part. And when you have Scorpius, who's been in the background of the episodes, never really coming to the forefront, but there is like a level of authority that the character has when the commander of the base he interact with is sort of always subservient. Mm-hmm. To have him just casually walk through a scene and say, grab that man, he's not so-and-so. Mm-hmm. Like, there was no buildup for it. There was just that moment of, this happened.
Yeah.
Which adds additional mystery about who Scorpius is and the joy that character is throughout for their existence in the show is amazing.
And that
character.
That's actually a really good point because, talk about playing with things. The show also plays with conventions in really interesting ways. And one of them is that this show was absolutely built up. This episode, I should say, it's absolutely built up to be a heist episode. They're going to go in. They're going to do a heist. A couple of things can go wrong, but eventually they'll make it out because they're very clever. And the heist gets busted. The train stops immediately. Scorpius like, nope, he's a traitor. And that's just it. He can't talk his way out of it. It's just he's beat up and dragged away. And it's like 5 seconds then, and the entire plan is now over. It's just like, and it's such a shock. It's like, whoa, because we're trained to be like, they've planned for this, well, way out of it. No, things went bad, and that's just how it is now. And you have to work with that new status quo. And they linger on that for a while, like, because John is tortured and tormented, and he's just flat stuck, and he gets very close to giving up the information they need, and like easily. A third of the story is just the fact that John's failed, which goes back to the original point. John is not infallible at all.
And it's not John that really saves him. It's the other love interest that rigs a trap for Scorpius to fall into, which then makes all the attention go towards Crace. And you get more of Crace's backstory and secrets. And it lets John sort of become more, not free, but it moves him from the chair. With now him having the knowledge about wormholes that he's been searching for this whole time to try to get home.
Right.
So it was layer on top of layer on top of layer for previous bits they built together. And one of my favorite parts about Farscape is that the first season and a half are really like almost individually episodes, but then it starts to take on a more narrative focus throughout the end of the final run of the show.
Right. Cause really the first season is we're in this situation and then Crace or something else will come up to influence things. And then the B plot in the background will progress, but each episode's relatively self-contained. Actually, One thing I did not notice, or didn't remember, I should say, was Krace's evolution, because like it's so slow. But when you watch, when you jump from episode 1 to episode 19, you see that Krace is steadily getting more and more obsessed and crazed as time goes on. And it's real. It's moving the goalposts very, very slightly each episode. But when you jump from 119, because one, he's like relatively buttoned up and in control, just a little obsessed. And by 19, he is like, I'm going to murder that guy. I'm going to find you. I'm going to murder him and bring him back to life and murder him again. He is not all there anymore.
It's like Ahab in the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that becomes exactly your obsession above all else.
Mm-hmm. And he is definitely fully Ahab because he's willing to go toe-to-toe with Scorpius and be like, no, this is what we're doing. And Scorpius is like, your jurisdiction, you should even be here. And the Krace episode one probably would have backed away and found another way to get to Crichton later. But by 19, he's like, no, we're doing this. This is happening. It's the closest I've ever been. I'm taking him.
I'm not sure if you remember this one, and it's one folks didn't have to watch, but there was sort of this psychic episode that happened in season one that had Krace and Crichton fighting, sort of put them in like this. It's very Star Trek, sort of like pull their psyches together, and they were fighting in this like arena area. I vaguely remember it, but hearing you say that re-sparked that memory. Had to fight, and that was another image that you had of Krace, his sort of slow descent from taking his more methodical approach to, I just want you dead.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like the vengeance for his brother thing, by the time you see him in 19, you start to realize that's just a thing he's telling himself at this point. It's not really about that anymore.
And it was also a great sort of, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
A great show for the Peacekeeper Society that when Krace shows up, Scorpius offhandedly mentions, you're compensated for the loss of your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And he's still doing this. Are we done with Nerve? Because I want to jump to the next one if we are.
We should probably mention, I forgot his name now. Crichton's prison mate. That's your side, my side.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Because he also sort of joins a crew for a while throughout for the show.
Oh, we did. I forgot about that part.
But that's it. Done.
And also, it was a neat little kind of gag, but dark humor of him really liking the pain machine. It's like, please one more. And it's a funny moment, but it goes back to what I was saying before about I remember Farscape being funny. It's like, it is funny, but it's so dark humor.
Yes.
As opposed to Buck Rogers, where you literally end on, a joke at the end of the episode, right?
In the freeze frame. Is,
right. Everyone laughs and put their hands up in the air, because again, it's kind of structured like a sitcom in my memory. But
speaking of which, a slight digression. Are you watching Murderville?
I watched the first episode of Murderville.
The freeze frame ending?
Yes.
It happens again. That's all I'll say.
Okay. Fair enough. We should probably talk about Murderville at some point. That is pretty good. But anyway, last one I picked was The Way We Weren't. And this is, I picked it because I remember it being a very strong Aaron Soon episode. And I thought it was worth kind of showing because she's kind of a really strong supporting character. And I wanted to show her evolution. I had forgotten it's also a pilot episode in terms of an episode focusing on pilot. And I also really forgot how bleak this episode is.
I was thinking that. It's like Eddie chose a happy one to end on.
Yeah, right? I was just like, no, this is about her overcoming her peacekeeper programming. And that is true. I had forgotten about murdering the previous pilot 10 seconds into the episode. And that kind of just setting the tone for the rest of it. It's about her remembering that she had killed pilots of previous living ships, not connecting the dots that one of the pilots she killed was the one that was actually the one that belonged on the ship she was on. And we learned that the new pilot is actually a really young member of a species who wasn't quite ready to actually be a pilot yet. And also that he was artificially grafted into the ship, which caused him pain constantly. Which I don't know if that actually came up before this episode. I don't know if that was like something that was invented for this episode, or they actually alluded to the fact that Pilot felt pain in previous episodes. I feel like that was relatively new to this episode.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
But no. I will, a slight segue, as I'm the king of segues, I guess, this episode. The recruitment that they were doing for the young pilot to convince Pilot to come and do this thing is the same tack that a lot of recruiters take when they're recruiting young people to join the military.
Really?
In the old days, they would go to like rural communities or other places where there weren't a lot of opportunities for young people. And then they would give them that same sort of speech, and they might take them to McDonald's or somewhere like that and like sort of not coerce them, but show them the old spiel, the shtick there, mm-hmm. to get them to come and sign up for an enlistment period.
Oh, wow.
And that was frequently done. I'm not sure if it's still done, but I've seen it a lot, and I know that was something that was tried on me.
That's wild. I had no idea.
So, Farscape.
So, Farscape, yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting because, once again, this is a character who's not only a puppet, but also you only really see a head and arms of. And they're not a mobile character. So whenever you're not in the engine room or the pilot room or whatever, you're seeing Pilot like on a hologram or whatever. So this is definitely the character when I was first watching that I least expected to get an actual character arc and character growth. But you're right. They do a good job of you really getting to see this is a young, inexperienced character. This is a character who's in way over his head, who has a lot of regret, and how he deals with that is actually feels very human. Like he first is extremely angry at Soon. And it takes a while to realize that he's actually angry at himself. But that's how people react. A lot of people will take out their self-loathing on other people. So it's like, I even though it's dramatic and it sets up opportunities for Aaron to kind of confront her past, it also feels very organic because it's like that. Most of us probably know people who have been so angry at somebody, almost irrationally so, and then you find out, oh, it's because something happened to them or they have a shared bad experience or something like that. And it just really – and also, I mean, it really gets into the fact that this alien species, they have a whole culture and their relationship with the ship, which is really, really interesting. Obviously, the whole living ship thing, because I'm going to talk about Moira a bit, it's really hard to communicate unless you give the ship a voice somehow. And they never do, I don't believe, on Farscape. But they still do.
I think that one part of Pilot's role, though.
Right. Pilot kind of acts as Moira's voice. And so there's a layer of characterization there because sometimes Pilot's speaking as Pilot, sometimes he's speaking as Moira. And he's usually pretty clear about when he's which, but sometimes he's not. And but we're at this now at this moment where he's not just the voice of the ship. He's his own person. And you don't lose any of the vibe of Moira being alive. It helps that this is the part where they're playing pretty heavily into the Moira's pregnant angle. So they can keep kind of bringing that up and then say, well, a living being being pregnant. Okay, well, it's easy to remember that they're alive if you're using a word like pregnant around them. But even then, a little thing like when there's problems with the ship or the power goes out, the characters will not go to sci-fi cliches of like, you know, we're losing power or shields are down or the engines are wrong. It's like, you know, Moira's injured. Moira's feeling sick. They constantly take the technobabble of space stuff and turn it into language about a living creature. So the characters and the actors are constantly reinforcing this thing to the point where you start to really buy into it. It takes a while, I think. But over time, you start to really buy into, no, Maury is actually a character on this show. And that's really hard to do. So, yeah. Do you have any other thoughts about Farscape? Anything we didn't cover yet?
I could say that it's one of my favorite science fiction shows, but I think I've started to say that a lot out of episodes. So it's a really good show. I'm trying to think of good things to say that won't spoil the ending for folks that haven't seen Farscape, but it is definitely one of the ones that people should go out and still watch because it was, like I said, groundbreaking for the time. It is still engaging, and for the weird aesthetic that they chose for it, that sort of 70s sci-fi camp with a modern day layer, makes it still a joy to watch currently. Unlike Buck, that had a similar vibe, it was very dated for the 70s, and you could feel it. Right. This doesn't have that. And it also was one of the things that sort of projected having a female badass as one of the primary characters. And they did a lot of work. They didn't shy away from sex at all in it. They understood that, like, these are different, regardless of your species, they would engage in, like, sexual activities. They wouldn't show it, but they would show you, like, chin up equivalently. But they were doing it, and they played into all those things. And, like, even the clothing choices for the characters sort of told you something about that character.
Absolutely. Completely agree. And Farscape's different shows a bit like Deep Space Nine, where, like you said, it becomes heavily serialized in the back two-thirds of the show, and it's kind of hard to, A, talk about those shows in isolation, but also B, you get into pretty heavy spoiler territory. So I think it is about midway through season two where that starts to change, but that's why I kind of stopped at episode five. But I agree. It's definitely a show worth binging. It's pretty easy to find online these days. And it's just an eminently watchable cast. Even if nothing interesting is happening, just watching these characters talk to each other is always fascinating. They do a great job and a great choice of actors.
So the game.
The game. What is the game?
If you had to commit a heist, who is the one character from the crew that you would choose and why?
Oh, geez.
There's an easy answer there, but the why, you got to explain out more of it.
Right. I mean, I feel like Chiana's the really obvious choice, but honestly, I mean, if I'm going to do a heist specifically, the character that has most of the skills that a heist would need should it go sideways, Chiana seems like a pretty strong choice. She has the manipulation skill. She can adapt to evolving situations. So I think she's a strong contender. That said, this is going to be weird. And I also think Rigel would be a good choice. Because his ability to just be arrogant and bluster his way into situations that he has no right being in is almost supernatural. He is the person that you send in to be the distraction, and he will distract everything while you're actually getting work done. So I either of those I think would work for me, depending on the heist in question.
Excellent. So mine, I wouldn't pick Chiana. I know Chiana is the easy one, but Chiana, I also feel, would sell you out from the middle of the heist to take the loot. Rigel is my second, because like you said, Rigel is the ultimate distraction point and would keep everyone engaged while you're doing whatever it is you're doing. I would probably choose Aaron, because heists always have a tendency to go wrong.
That is true.
Regardless of how great the plan is. And when it goes wrong, you need someone to make sure they can extract the team.
And that's a good point. yeah, I, to be fair, I mean, it's a good heist team all around. So, I mean, any member of the crew would at least have some value on the team. Which is interesting because the show's not, even though we watched the episode involved the heist, it's not set up to be necessarily that. I don't know. I think what I'm trying to say
they're a great role-playing party.
They're a great role-playing party, I think that. And also, I think I'm trying to say is that Farscape is better than Firefly, so.
I think that goes without saying, too.
We're going to get so much hate for that, but I don't care.
One more game, since we can't play the captain's game.
Okay. Okay,
but you're probably going to be less than amusing me at this one, but it just struck me before we're wrapping up. Oh, yeah. If you had to rank the shows we've watched so far.
Oh, God damn it.
You know it's coming. Remember when you said there was only one episode to watch this week? And I said, curses Eddie in the sky. You can say curses curse right now. How would you rank the shows we've watched so far?
Okay. So of the shows we watched, I'm going to have to rank Buck Rogers at the bottom. I think I love the campy nature of it, but it's sometimes hard to watch and rewatch. Above that, weirdly, Battlestar Galactica for kind of similar reasons. Like I enjoyed watching it at the time, but I didn't have a strong desire to watch it because I think it's a show that relies so much on its twists that once you know the twists, it's not as fun to watch it again. Above that, OG Star Trek. I think it's still pretty watchable, even years later, but it's not something I'd seek out necessarily. It's one of those, oh, it's on TV, or, you know, oh, I skimmed by it on Netflix kind of thing. Now we're getting into the tough ones. So after that, Dark Matter, and that's really only because I haven't watched too much of it yet. I think if I watched more of it, I would probably want to rank it higher. But right now, just because I know what I saw I liked, and I so much that I went to watch more of it, I don't think I think I have to watch the whole thing to make a proper judgment. So I think putting that in the middle is probably pretty safe. Then Farscape, because Farscape scratches a lot of the itch that Dark Matter does, but I've seen Farscape. So it's like, okay, I have a better sense of what that is. Deep Space Nine, and then Babylon 5 at the top. Because during our Deep Space Nine conversation, you kind of convinced me that Babylon 5 does everything Deep Space Nine does slightly better. And I think that's fair. Because Deep Space Nine spends years trying to find its feet, whereas Babylon 5 is assured what it wants to be from the get-go. I think that strong start helps to push it over the top.
Did you know that, speaking of B5, did you know that originally I think Farscape was supposed to have Leonardo as a 5-year thing before it got canceled?
Yeah, and then they kind of crammed season 5 into the Peacekeeper Wars, and apparently they had to shop around to get someone to invest in that before it got made. Unbelievable. So, how about you?
So, I don't get to escape my own game.
Curses!
So, for me, Battlestar Galactica is actually at the bottom of the bottom of the rung for me. For a couple of different reasons. Some of it is the people know my opinions about Adama already, but for a show made in 2000, I wanted it to have more diversity and more primary roles in what it did.
That's fair.
So that hurts it a lot for me as a Black viewer. Mm-hmm. And then the story itself, like you said, relies on too many of its own twists and turns. And then the ending sort of pulled like any sort of joy I had in the show out.
Yeah, no, for people who now remember the outcry about the last season of Game of Thrones, that was a lot of us in 2003, at the end of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah. On top of that, I would probably have to go Buck Rogers. It's close between the two I'm about to talk about. But Buck is too dated, and it's just too focused on one dude being the best dude that's ever duded. So everyone else wants to dude like that dude.
Yeah.
That dude did duded. I don't think I threw dude there one more time.
Dude.
Thank you. Next is going to be the OG Star Trek. My experience with OG is somewhat limited, mm-hmm. but it was trying to be as progressive as it could at the time. Mm-hmm. And there are some amazing episodes. I've seen a few amazing episodes of it. Mm-hmm. Then there's also some really ones that I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Was that even good when you made it?
Right.
Now it gets a little sticky. I'm going to say Dark Matter. I like Dark Matter, mm-hmm. but Dark Matter is missing something. And like that something that it's missing, I don't know what it is. It scratches the itch, but it doesn't like stop the itch for when I'm looking for a sci-fi show.
I think, especially when I'm putting up against Farscape, I think for me, some of it is it's not quite as weird. It doesn't quite embrace the weird enough.
I think that's it. And then there's Farscape. The beauty and joy that is Farscape. Mm-hmm. I think I'm down to my last two. I know that people don't know what I'm going to say.
Yep, just saying.
Deep Space Nine is amazing. It is amazing. But that first two seasons, like, bring it down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the top rung is Babylon 5. Babylon 5 was a great idea from the inception. It had like the 5-year arc that was already planned. And even though they lost their last season, then to regain it, the last season is the weakest season. Well,
sure. Get back.
The first and last seasons are weak.
Well, okay. Yeah, definitely.
And so unlike Deep Space Nine that had, I think, 7 seasons, mm-hmm. they spent the first couple of seasons ramping up to find their footing. Babylon 5 had a rocky start, then great middle and a stumble at the end. So you have more of a cohesive, this is awesome. For most of your time, that you're instantly engaged with it,
right? DS9 takes a slow burn to get to the good stuff. So
that's my ranking. We're pretty close still.
Yeah, I say our rankings are pretty close actually. Really, it's just kind of the bottom three that we're differ on most. Everything else is like pretty solid.
I should have come up with my joke rankings and said, Buck Rogers is number one.
I mean,
that for an hour.
That is a choice you could make if you wanted to. but speaking of choices, we are about to wrap up our first season of this. So what is our finale for the season going to be?
So we wanted to do something a little different for the final show of the season for folks who have been listening. So we at Journalists are actually going to bring in a special guest, so you have to wait for the next episode to know who it is. Mm-hmm. But we're going to talk about, this may sound familiar, one of the best sci-fi shows that was ever created. And you can rest assured that means it's probably in the 70s. We're going to talk about the legend that is Blake 7.
Indeed, which I have only watched a little bit of, so it's going to be great.
For folks that are looking for it, because Blake 7 may be a little bit hard to find, I know it's on Amazon BritBox. You could potentially scour YouTube and find the episodes. But mm-hmm. we're going to be watching 5 episodes of it. The first 2 episodes, The Way Back and Spacefall. Then Season 1, Episode 8, Duel. Season 1, Episode 13, Orca. And lastly, Season 3, Episode 6, City at the Edge of the World. And we're going to have the 3 of us here talking about one of the greatest science fiction shows ever made.
Unlike the other shows, which were also the greatest science fiction show ever made.
See, I told you it's becoming a thing. It'll be my staple for going forward.
You know what?
And there will be new games next time.
Oh, you're going to plan for games now? That's because we have a new bit.
I think I have to come up with something a little bit more creative and just not, I should think of something in the next 2 minutes.
Well, you know, we have company coming over, so we got to, you know, dress up nice and make sure all the silverware is out.
I will resist now singing David Byrne's Everybody's Coming to My House. Just barely. Because that is one of my favorite Talking Head songs.
Fair enough. Well, if people wanted to get in touch with you online and sing that song with you, where would they find you?
@darker_hue on Twitter and in the Discord. We're actually talking a lot more on the Discord these days. And for people that are listening, we're actually debating about doing a special event. We're still working on some of the details, so stay tuned.
And you can also find me in the Discord, Darker Hue Discord. You can also find me on Twitter as Pugsteady, PUGSTEADY, or you can find my website at pugsteady.com. And so until next time, we will catch you all later as we get ready to go into space in Lake 7. Catch you all later.
Take care.